just tell you how this is going to work. Brendan is going to give a quick talk just to cover some of the issues that's involving people, and then we're going to have three people at the front who know a bit about this stuff, and we're going to have a panel session, and it's up to you to ask all the questions about what you want answered. So I'm going to hand over to Brendan now.
Okay. Thanks, Tim, and thank you for inviting me along. Thanks to all of you for coming along today. My name's Brendan. I'm a lawyer, and I'm here to talk to you about FOSS licences for content developers. And by and large, that's not going to be FOSS licences. That's by and large going to be GPL. But in the process of talking about that, that's sort of like I'm going to give you an overview of copyright. And it's like a one-slide introduction of copyright, which will be very quick and short and sweet, cover the main issues. Have a look at, and this is probably the more sort of interesting point, is how does content get created? What's the process? Because it's through analysing this process that we're going to see some differences between how code is created and how content is created. And then we're going to take those differences and plug them into the source code requirements for the GPL. Right at the end, I'm going to give some comments on Creative Commons, which are probably can be summarised as wait for version 3. Alright, so what can you say about copyright? Copyright is a regulatory regime and covers different works, of which software is one. It also covers other sorts of things, other subject matter such as audio, video, pictures, those sorts of things. The Copyright Act uses a lot of words which appear to be plain English words, which when you actually take them to court, they mean something rather different from what a lot of people would tend to take them to mean. So my short comment here is don't try to understand it. Just give up and
and pay you to understand it.
That's right. the easiest way of dealing with it is finding a copyright owner, asking them what the license terms are, and then comply with those license terms. If you've got a lot of time and effort, you may be able to find loopholes in the law which allow you to do things other than what the license terms say, but it is a lot of effort. You're going to be spending your time in vain if you're chasing down those issues. And the other thing to note about copyright is that it's not like there's just one copyright that you have to worry about. Copyright is something which has a whole lot of parallel streams. So if you've seen a movie recently, there's actually not just a copyright on the movie, there's also a whole lot of other ancillary copyrights which also need to be addressed. So things like the script in the movie, the soundtrack in the movie, the musical work, the music, the score from which the soundtrack was created. All those things are potential issues for you if you're dealing with a movie. And you have to clear all of those copyrights and get all of those copyrights done. The takeaway message is it's very complex. If you get it wrong, the liability regime is set up so that you can be punished quite a lot for the fact that you got it wrong. So the summary is find a copyright owner, get their license, and just comply with the license, if you can understand. The second part of the talk, I'm going to give you sort of a discussion about the content side of things and how content is created. This is a patch file from a program called Reason. I don't know if anyone ever heard of Reason. use them to create audio. I'm using audio because it's something that I've done, but the things that I'm going to talk about are analogous for anything else that you're doing, the same sort of issues again. Now, what this is you can't see it because it's off the screen, but this is a synthesizer, and if you twiddle the knobs, it's a virtual synthesizer, so it's a software synthesizer. If you twiddle the knobs and feed some notes into it, it'll produce sound. And by changing the knobs, you change the timbre of the sound, so the character of the sound. Not necessarily whether it's loud or not so loud, but whether it sounds like a saxophone or a flute, for example. This changed, for example. But that's the basic idea behind it. This screenshot is from a sound effect that I have produced for a game called Q. If anyone's heard of Q, but it's not in Q, so don't go looking for it. So what happens is you set the sound up, and once you've got the sound sounding how you like it, you export the sound to a WAV file, which is this. So once I'm happy with it, I'll export that, and I'll open it. So I might have just snapped it as I've dropped it. Right, I export it to a WAV file, but if you can see down the end here, it just falls off a cliff once it gets to the end of the file. So what I'm going to have to do there is change that file so that it falls off the end of the cliff. The other thing I want to say about this slide is now that it's in this format, there are things that I cannot do with it that I could have done in the previous format. Right, so I can no longer, there are some ways that I can change the timbre of the sound, but the flexibility that I've got to change is greatly reduced now that it's in this format, this WAV format, as opposed to the reason format. And in this format, I can edit some of these characteristics in a much easier way than I could have, for example, in the reason format. Now here, what I'm saying is, at the end of it, the sound falls off the edge of the cliff. And that means that the sound will have a clicking at the end of it, and that's bad news if you've got a sound effect in your game, and every time it plays, it clicks. So I want to get rid of the click, so I'll use SoundForge to select a more or less arbitrary point. I'll just select it. And then I'll choose this fade this fellow out button, and I'll fade it out. And the thing to note about what I've just done is there's been no record made anywhere of what I've done. Right? So I've destructively edited the file, and I've got no means of recreating that destructive edit that I've just done. There are other things that I could do, downsample, so I can convert it to mono MP3. I can do a whole heap of things, all of which will be just like this. I'll destructively edit the file, and I'll have no record of the fact that I've destructively edited the file. So some observations. First is the first WAV file I created, I can create from the RAS file, from the RISC file, but I cannot automatically create the final file that I finished with from the initial file. I can sort of have a go at it. If I try it again, I'll get something pretty close, because I'll sort of go, oh, yeah, it looks like where the fade started there, and I'll apply it. How well you can do that will depend on quite a lot of things which may not be obvious to you, especially if you've got a feedback mechanism in any of your sound files. A small difference will create a big change in the output. So it may not even be possible to get something close. So from that I wanted to draw out some differences between code and content, which I probably anticipated in the previous slides. But basically, when you're building code, you're using tools which are recording what you're doing, and which you can just dump into a function which produces an output. When you're creating content, there's a lot more interactivity in the tools that you're doing. Right? So it's not like you set it and forget it. You're actually in there working with it to do something. There's very little auditability or buildability. And by that I mean you don't have something which describes what you've done. All you've got is your memory of what you've done. But no independent record of it. Some other things to say is the storage format of a piece of code doesn't tend to affect its utility. You experience your code by passing through a computer and seeing the program logic working. But for content, your experience of things directly through the perception of it. So it sounds awful, it sounds nice. And the sort of hardware you've got actually affects your perception of the thing that you've got, perception of the code. So that's the sort of the code, that's the creation of some content section of the talk. I sort of wanted to talk about the GPL, and this slide is justifying why I'm talking about the GPL. This is just a straw poll of some games that I had a look at, and most of them were in the GPL. And those that weren't didn't have a source code disclosure requirement.
GPL for the source code, for the content?
These are the games, and all I've done in this straw poll is looked at the about the file, and it says GPL.
I'll give you the answer. I guess my question. Like, the GPL only covers source code, it does not cover music, images, textures.
In which one?
Quake.
Okay. Well, that's only because the Quake. Well, I don't know. I think what it is that what's being released in Quake is the code and none of the images. I'm under the gun to get this done.
He's got about five minutes to finish his talk. So please,
GPL,
no questions.
The GPL has these obligations in it. I'm making the assumption I don't really have to explain the GPL too much in detail to you. This is an interesting one. This is an interesting one. We were talking about Reason and SoundForge. The programs that I put up, and neither of those is an open source tool. But one of the things in the GPL is you have to provide source code for everything is in the compiler components normally distributed with the operating system. And so the question is, do you have to provide source code for the closed source tools that you're using? And this is from the GPL3, GPL2 FAQ on the FSF's site, which basically says closed source tools are okay, so I breathe a sigh of relief, even though I've been using Reason and SoundForge. Okay, do you need to distribute under the GPL if you've got some content with your GPL program file? And the answer to that question is it depends on what you're going about it. If you're distributing some content completely separately from the GPL code, then the answer is probably you don't. And that's subject to this comment down the bottom, that there are worrying cases on derivative works and authorisation in Australia. If you are packaging up your content with the program file, then it's more likely than not that the content will be subject to the GPL. The GPL is on the software. And that's because of the wording of the GPL. I don't think there's some mere aggregation stuff, but I don't think it would apply if you're sticking it in a zip file or an RPM package or something like that. So, complying with the GPL. GPL requires us to include the preferred form of the content for the purposes of modification. And the issue that we discovered earlier was there were a number of different formats, none of which permitted the flexibility of modification that all of the others permitted. There's no one format which you can see that gave you all the answers. And the difficulty with the GPL is it does talk about the preferred form. And so it may be that this is a requirement which is difficult, if not impossible, to comply with, depending upon the process you've gone through of creating the content. If you've got something which is the creation of the sounds goes through a script, you can just put those scripts in and you've got the problem. But if you've gone through an interactive creation process, then you're going to be a little bit more difficult. Either give up or be pragmatic, and how pragmatic you're going to be depends upon what your ideology is. And that's something that you're just going to have to work out for yourselves and work out with the community that's distributing the game. You can make your own assessment of what you think is probably going to be what people want. That may be the WAV file, may be the reason file, maybe some competition. I might talk about that in the next slide. Okay, this is a more complex example. We're on the downhill slope for getting the talk finished, Tim. This is a song which I've put together but not released. Each of these is an audio clip from a public domain movie. And this is a sonar. This is from a program sonar. Each of those is an audio clip. Which means I would probably need to include not only this sonar file, but a copy of the audio clips if I wanted to do the source. This is a pad sound, and the way this pad was created was an earlier version of this file sent MIDI out to the Reason synthesizer, which synthesized the sounds, fed it back to Cakewalk. Cakewalk then reduced it to an audio file. So, even the fact that I've got this audio clip raises the issue of, well, do I need to also include the source for this audio clip? Because I've already reduced it to an audio file. See what else is on there. Down here, set of MIDI information, which is a string of notes. And those notes, again, are doing what I was talking about here. They're just sending notes off to the synthesizer, and the synthesizer says, oh, I've got a note. I'll make that sound with the synthesizer, and I'll send the sound back to SoundForge. And the difficulty for you here, if you're distributing this, is in order to modify it and recreate it in the future, you need to know what the patch file is in that soft synthesizer that's out there in order to recreate the sound that's created by those MIDI files. So the thing I wanted to say here is it can be extremely complex to work out what the source code is for a piece of content. And the way in which you're developing something going to greatly affect the expertise with which you can determine it. Those things that I put into public domain, in order for me to put things out of the GPL, I need to put those clips that I've been including under the GPL, which means the license for those clips has to permit my licensing under the GPL. And that may mean that using things like royalty-free stock content, if it doesn't permit GPL-like licensing, means you may not be able to distribute it under the GPL. CC licenses, pretty much all of them, except CC GPL, and all the GPL. Most, probably all of them, are incompatible with the free software guidelines and the open source definition, up to version 2.5 of the parent copies. There's the chance that CC, these two licenses, buy and buy share alike version 3, will be DFSG compatible. We'll have to see what comes. So takeaway message is, if you're using Creative Commons up to version 2.5, that's not open source. So if you're concerned about open source in the game, you can't use Creative Commons, which is a bit disappointing. I might just wrap it up there, thanks.
Okay, cool. Good. Everyone, I say thank you. Appreciation. Kept one bottle of South Australian wine.
Oh, that's great.
So I'm afraid. Okay, cool. I'm afraid that I don't drink wine, so it could be horrible.
He's to all the speakers, so there might be much choice later.
Yes.
I'm getting
ready up to people later. Yeah. Okay, now I've got Rusty Russell. Yes, Kimberly and Brendan. Brendan. you need to take your seat.
I do need to take my chair.
Can we have the lights up? Okay, if you want to ask a question, put your hand up and I'll point at you and then.
And make it loud.
Yes, make your question loud. We're recording, but our speaker is, our microphone is pretty crappy, so. Okay.
I have a question for Brendan on the reason I'm here is the difference between code and content licensing. I have not seen before things like Cakewalk and tools that don't have experience in Cinematic Clutch,
mm-hmm.
where you have interstitial lists and performing, which are exactly make source material, service into a form process, which is fully just. The reasons for that in Cinematic Clutch are about the amount of money involved, and there really are large global teams making changes.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for code having these tools are, again, the code is something that we pick up a body of code and make small changes to. Is that something that is relevant, the ability to pick up existing work and make some changes to it for audio, video, etc.
Yeah.
Outside the context of large industrial cinematic production?
Well, I think if you asked that question maybe 15 years ago, people would have said no, the way you get content is to have a permit sitting in a corner somewhere and they just bash it out for 15 years and they create their own cycles. My feeling is jury's still out on that, but I suspect that it is important to be able to do small iterative changes to things. And I can't see any reason in theory why content wouldn't be amenable to the same sort of development, distributed development processes that the code is amenable to.
Yeah. What would the other panel people think?
Thank you, Tim. we have this issue in Westlaw, which we have GPL and everything, including the images and sound and everything. you really do want it, because you'd be surprised what people want to do. They want to shrink something to make a trailer, or they want to, you know, and they really do need to get in there and mangle it. And, you know, just sometimes just because you can't think of a good reason for them to want to do it, that's exactly why you should let them do it. Because it's the things you can't think of, they're the cool stuff. So I would tend to err, and it's probably my coding background, on the side of, you know, put it all out there and see what they do. But as a general utility thing, yes, it's probably less useful in some practical sense than in some other cases like source code, where it's obvious. But how much of that is a cultural experience? Because the culture of code reuse, and, you know, people don't look at you funny when you say hack on free software as an IT person. But it's very different in the music and content creation industries. They just don't have that kind of culture at the moment.
If anything, might be a reason for actually, you know, putting these kinds of terms up front in dealing with, you know, people who are creating music or have created pictures and, you know, are saying, oh yeah, you can put this in the game, or, you know, you can use my characters or whatever. Put the terms up front. If you're going to, if you want these freedoms, these modifications, you know, it's got to be out there and up front, because it's not at all uncommon for people in the content, the more content creation kind of areas, to say, oh yeah, no, don't screw with my work. You know, don't change the size of this, don't mangle it, don't make it black and white, because that's not the effect I wanted.
And no commercial use.
Yeah.
Very
which,
common.
Which is very,
very
CC. Cool.
The CC, and if you look at how CC licenses are used, of course a lot of people are using no deribs, no commercial use.
Yes. Yeah. You make the publish one work for me. Thank you.
That's basically
free advertising license.
Yay, great. What next, now that they've done it, the DMCA, from your perspectives, that you've all been very active in trying to get them to see sense, and for you all, it's probably a change in mode now that this has happened, and does that sort of impact, or is that off topic for here?
I think we're a little bit off topic, and there's going to be a session.
The Creative Commons people are looking at a nifty tool for being able to rescind the rights you've given with your thing that you've put out there freely after 35 years. Is that off topic too?
That was not quite my understanding of the situation.
Yeah.
But
what was your understanding?
My understanding is that there is, that creators in the US have the right to cancel any contractual obligations that they had after 35 years. Then Creative Commons were trying to set up a process by which people can exercise that right in order to release them under Creative Commons license themselves.
Yeah.
The question of whether that mechanism would also allow someone to revoke a Creative Commons license is something I am just completely unqualified for. But what they're trying to do is basically take things that are closed, and because the author can now decide if they use this mechanism to open them themselves, even though they have contracted away the right to do that under normal circumstances.
Well, it's interesting that in their fact they're talking about, yes, this applies to stuff where you've released it in a context which is participatory, where it's collectively developed. You can reduce, you know, rescind the rights on that. So,
I don't think you can.
The US legal position where you can actually rescind, you know, the special author's right, doesn't actually apply in a context where there's multiple authors. So that's one legal thing. You will see a lot of discussion on Creative Commons licenses in particular, where people are saying, oh, well, it's just a bare license, they could revoke it at any time. Because particularly if you think under Australian law, a contract without consideration, you know, means it's just a bare license, that means it could be revoked by the creator at any time. Yes, in contract law that is true. The fact though is that there's all sorts of other principles in law that would step in if people have been relying on their freedoms, then estoppel would step in probably and prevent full revocation if it's going to cause harm. So, you know, there's a lot of fear mongering about the revocation. I think it's less of an issue than some people think. You've seen that discussion.
I'm sorry. We had a person here who's first.
Thinking about what you were saying about the destructive editing, when thinking about how is sort of copyright enforced in terms of content. In a way, I say not so much songs, things where there's quite fairly obvious it's a derivative, but in terms of sound effects, samples, process samples, and so on. Because if you look at a certain long-running lawsuit involving two three-letter companies, there have been quite a few arguments about, you know, show us the lines and the files and lines, give us the source code repository, plus all the logs, etc., etc., with the argument boiling down to, you know, compare A to B. How do you compare two, you know, sort of sound effects of roughly the same duration when both are being produced by destructive processes, and how do you determine that one really is from the other and not created by a completely different process and just ended up sounding similar?
Well, if it's important enough, you get roomfuls of lawyers to go through and, you know, look at the history of the document, of the thing. It is going to be a question of evidence. If you don't have the evidence, you can't prove the case. And presumably a case like this can get started unless, surely there must be evidence. So.
All right. Two important things. One, copyright, of course, only protects against copying,
yes.
But recreating does count for a lot of things, not for sound recording. You know, so if you listen to the sound, I really like that sound, I'm just going to create something exactly like it. Not good enough. For most types of copyright material, there's some complications, but probably don't need to get into that. So, second thing is how much do people follow the sampling concept, particularly when it comes to sound recordings? Absolutely. There have been cases, more than one, about, you know, particular riffs taken from songs, usually between different musicians. I mean, you've probably heard of the Verve case. You know, the fact that that really famous song, The Verve, I can't remember what it was called.
Bittersweet
Symphony. Used a riff from the Rolling Stones music. In fact, all of the royalties from that song went to the Rolling Stones because of that copy of one riff from a song. And, you know, that's maybe one extreme example, but there have been a number of cases in the sampling area. I mean, it depends on the culture, of course, how much it's going to be enforced, you know, amongst DJs and things that are using each other's stuff, maybe not a problem. Using commercial stuff, a huge problem.
But the takeaway message is don't use it. You know, create from scratch your own stuff. Don't base it on other people's work unless you've got some sort of copyright problem.
Do you have a comment for us? No.
I think the takeaway message is not a shortcut, guys.
Okay. Specifically, you're talking about musicians reusing other stuff. I mean, if you have a look at 12 Bar Blues, there is so much reuse of that absolutely everywhere. Every blues musician knows this. Obviously, that's a culture thing within that subgroup. I mean, how can you... I mean, you throw this at a bunch of lawyers and you say, okay, he used my 12 Bar Blues riff, but I modified this and he used it, therefore, you know... Where do they sort of throw the limit at, draw that line? Because there's so much reuse in some parts and no none in others, and how can we sort of avoid this concept? No, the question is more how can we sort of avoid this? It's like, you know, we can't go to every musician and go, is this your own piece of work? And they say yes, so we trust them. It's not, and then we get our ass kicked because, you know, we use their work.
I think that's a process which should apply to everything that you're including in any project. You have a process for checking out the bona fides of the contribution of the project.
Okay, so that's actually a really good bugbear of mine. So you can kill a project by setting the bar too high with contributions. At the end of the day, if you make a good faith attempt, you know, and somebody else completely, like, maliciously fucks you over, well, you know, they could run you down with their car. This isn't the only area where that could happen. So, you know, take reasonable precautions. And if you're in a high exposure area, say there was a major lawsuit or something, you might decide to start some kind of sign-off process on contributions, for example. But generally, going to the extreme with the FSF's approach, where you have to sign a copyright clearance and you have to sign a copyright to them, does raise a significant bar to new contributions. You know, there have been whole projects started over exactly the difficulty involved submitting patches, for example. So, it's actually really hard. Don't get too scared. That would be my advice. You know, and if something comes up, then talk to a lawyer.
Yeah, A, talk to a lawyer, and B, you know, make sure that you can be, if you can, be flexible about taking stuff out. You know, obviously, you can take anything questionable out. Huge implications in terms of reducing the risk. You know, you're going to end up having to pay.
I'd just like to inject with our project, 1000 Parsec, we keep good logs of where things came from. So if somebody had submits a piece of artwork for to put in our repository, we record who they are, how to contact them, and then if somebody modifies, we have like standard type author files, so that you know they modified it, and kind of, and we use an SVN repository to keep track of all the changes. So if somebody, say, accidentally includes or deliberately includes, say, an Eminem song inside one of our things, we know who did it, when it occurred, and we can actually get back to a previous version before this occurred. And that's how we try and deal with it.
Yeah, it's sensible management.
I think you're first. Sorry.
Brendan, just wanted to clarify. Were you saying that the GPL kind of doesn't really mean as much with things like music and graphics? Or are you saying that it's just not particularly the best thing to use for free music and graphics?
I'm saying neither of those things. I'm saying the way that the GPL is worded, the assumptions that it makes about the creation of your work that it's subject to don't necessarily apply with content, because the tool sets you're using to create the content don't maintain the audit trail. Someone said that they're asking to do, but the ones that I'm being aware of, they don't maintain the audit trail. So it makes it difficult to make sense of the requirements of the GPL.
So how does that inform a decision of whether or not GPL content?
Well, I guess that's a different sort of, that's a different issue, because what you're doing there is content, which is just existing independently, but trying to think that's doing with something, doing with it. Because I'm talking about it in the context of a game which already exists, which is under GPL.
Right.
So if you've got some content you want to make the most of it, really choosing a license is a difficult process, and you have to sit down and think about your objectives.
And more
yeah. Well, basically that's the
yeah. Yeah, cool. Flip 3.0 and CC licenses will make
yeah.
the process easier. So
they are trying to make sure that this stuff can be incorporated into the work with the GPL, at least for some of the Creative Commons licenses. You do need to be careful about which one.
Does the GPL probably might be different?
Yeah, okay. That's related to what you just said.
Does the GPL 3 make any difference? The second draft of GPL 3. It has some provisions about aggregation which are more favourable than GPL 2 and may permit packaging in your RPM file or music file or whatever it is. In terms of the source code obligation, it's still there. It's worded in a sort of different way, but I don't think it's going to change the analysis we've got. So by and large, no.
When you were saying ordinary people really don't have a hope of understanding copyright, so don't bother, should we at least maybe keep fair use alive, try to encourage people to understand a bit about fair use, how much they can take, or is that
I mean, the interesting thing is we don't have fair use in Australia. So
well, we have fair dealing, which is
And trying to fall into the fair dealing exceptions. I've never encountered anybody, perhaps outside the universities, who have been able to fall into those fair dealing exceptions. You know, you've got to have processes to get in them, and they're not very
they're highly
generous.
Specific.
They're not very generous, is the word.
Yeah. The law as we have it is highly specific. The fair dealing defences are highly specific. particularly the ones that apply to the kinds of stuff that you guys might be interested in. That in terms of creativity and using, reusing material creatively, Fairdealing does not help you. Pretty much full stop. It's very much focused on, criticism and reviews, people who are writing nice academic articles, or, similar kinds of things.
If you're writing a satirical game, maybe.
Yes, a parody or a satire. What that means...
You could be a test case.
Don't call me! Please don't call me. In terms of what it's important to do, views differ. I don't think that everyone should be trying to understand every aspect of the copyright law. I spend my life doing this, and it takes me my life to do this, to understand this. In terms of where we're going, of course, in some senses preempting the kinds of things I want to talk about on Thursday morning when I'm talking about copyright law. But the brief message is it is important, I think, that people who understand, you guys who are free software type people, help creators understand the importance of some of these freedoms and encourage them to make their stuff over. Even if it's only starting to use the Creative Commons licenses, because whatever you say about them, they are more open than copyright. And getting people into these, thinking about these licenses, thinking about making their stuff available creatively is good. And you want other kinds of content creators to be thinking about that.
In some circumstances, there's a degree of healthy apathy about trying to find a presentation that you enjoy that didn't involve some kind of copyright violation is actually quite difficult, for example. But when you're talking about mass distribution of stuff, then you have to perhaps become a little bit more careful. But don't do anything completely stupid, and it just hasn't been a big issue yet for individuals who don't have a bucket of money.
And if you think it is a big issue for you, tell your MP. And I'm serious about that. The more people go and tell their MPs that they're upset about it, the more attention
But as a lawyer, I don't want you guys wasting all your time thinking about copyright.
Really?
The Access to Knowledge lobby is interested in the role of information in society and coming up with treaties and stuff that are at WIPO for people who want to set up a coherent framework that can be worked on as a a response to copyright. Can we do that with gaming type culture stuff? Is that something that we can do?
Just before anybody says anything, it's actually 11:40. So if you desperately need lunch, we're technically in lunch break now. If you want to come back after lunch, we're not going to be in this room. We're going to be next door, which is actually bigger. Tell all your friends so we can fill up that room too. If you stay around for the end of this talk, can you please help us move tables? The education mini-conf is moving into this room, and they want their table set up in a different way. We'll also want the tables in the education mini-conf room, which is where we're moving, moved around as well. So if you could help out, that would be brilliant.
Lunch, you said.
Where do you think you're going?
So we'll just a couple of seconds so that people who really need to leave are going, and then we'll continue with... Sorry, I don't know your name. It depends whether everybody is in now.
I think everyone's in.
Yeah.
I think the answer is yes. We're inside a little bubble here.
Move around, or just have a bit more freeform discussion.
Sharing is stealing.
Major
responses. Just to get people to think about these questions.
As something beyond the side that belongs to an individual, as something that's a function.